From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunnyvale, California.
Oakland, California.
Oakland, California.
North Oakland.
North Oakland.
North Berkeley.
South Berkeley.
Adams Point.
Yosemite.
Coming up, we'll celebrate 60 years of Bay Area literary history at City Lights Bookstore.
Well, it's so unique. I mean, it's the opposite of, you know, Barnes & Noble.
Then how filmmakers took the work of one of those City Lights writers, the legendary Allen Ginsberg, and managed to adapt it to film.
We really wanted to try to capture that youthful, rebellious spirit that gave birth to the poem.
And we honor a bookstore fighting for survival after decades of serving the Bay Area's African-American community.
We've had more writers than the whole Harlem Renaissance.
We'll dip into San Francisco's literary past and present today on Cross Currents. It's been 60 years since poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti decided to open City Lights Bookstore in the heart of San Francisco's North Beach. It was the first all-paperback bookstore in the country to also serve as a publishing house, a business move that changed the game of bookselling forever. It didn't take long for City Lights to become the center of the beat literary scene. By the 1960s, it was practically home to writers like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. Now, the three-floor bookstore is still owned by Ferlinghetti, and it remains in its original location, where tourists come to browse the shelves and take pictures of books and posters on the walls. KLW's Holly J. McDeed recently visited City Lights and took a tour with employee Stacy Lewis to see how it's managed to keep its history alive and to avoid the fate of so many local bookstores that have closed over the years. She brings us back this audio postcard.
So we're about to enter City Lights Bookstore, and we're celebrating the 60th anniversary. And so as we enter in at 261 Columbus, this space here, the front counter, this sort of triangular space right here, was the entirety of the bookstore.
Yeah, right now. Hello, City Lights.
I tied in that towel.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm Vanessa, and I guess I'm a bookseller. So I've worked here for a month. It's great. It's sometimes a little overwhelming. People come here expecting a very specific experience. Like, people come here knowing the history, come here knowing about the beats all the time, all the time. So much, I'm just like, through the arch upstairs, through the arch upstairs. That's where Howl is.
So we're in the main room of City Lights Bookstore, and this is where you'll find fiction, European literature, hardcover, nonfiction, hardcover fiction, and then also all the publications that City Lights has in print. City Lights publishes books and has since 1955.
My name is Jason Forsyth. I'm just here traveling from New York. So I'm a big fan of City Lights books my whole life. Wrote my thesis on Kerouac and come here every time I go to San Francisco. But right now, I'm looking at a book about absinthe, the drink.
So now we're going to continue going upstairs, up to the third level of the store, which is the poetry room.
My name is Cynthia Wilson. My memories of this bookstore from the late 60s, early 70s, I was in high school and studying literature so assiduously. This was the hippest, coolest, most progressive, radical place you could find literature of all stripes. So now it's many, many, many years later, and I'm showing my niece, my 14-year-old niece, this marvel of a bookstore.
Also, what you'll find here is our beat literature section, and of course, we published Howl by Allen Ginsberg. We've also published Jack Kerouac. We probably have every Kerouac book that is published and in print. As you'd imagine, one of our bestsellers is On the Road.
Well, it's so unique. I mean, it's the opposite of, you know, Barnes & Noble or any other kind of corporate bookstore. This is a Question Authority bookstore. The most outlandishly inventive and creatively leaning writers. This is all the same, and I'm so happy that that's true.
So I can take you downstairs to the basement? Okay.
My name's Angela Redden. I'm a visitor from Tennessee, and I've always wanted to come here because it was fearless. You know, if you look back at, you know, from reading about Ginsburg and Howe and the trials and how Ferlinghetti just insisted that he was going to carry the book. And I just think that it's important. I brought my son here because I wanted him to know.
My name's Laura Sims. I'm visiting from England, London. I'm looking at a book. I was particularly interested in looking at books that were published by City Lights because they're ones that you can't get anywhere else. And this book is called A Little Matter of Genocide. And it's looking quite interesting. It's about the massacre, I guess, of Indians in America over a large period of time.
Okay, so now we're back in the main room, and so we're going to head into the area that we set aside just for staff. More funky spaces, unusual bookshelves. We're heading up the stairs.
I'm Elaine Katzenberger, and I'm the publisher of City Lights Books and the executive director of City Lights Booksellers and Publishers. I remember the first day I worked here, back in 1987, knowing that I was home, you know, around people who care about the things that I care about. The people who work here are involved in all kinds of cultural activities themselves and are avid readers and listeners to music and watchers of film and know about history. It's kind of like working in an encyclopedia. If there's ever something I don't know, there's always someone here who knows. I don't really need Wikipedia because there's always someone here who knows. And it's kind of fabulous that way.
I'll take you into Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Nancy Peters' office. Lawrence and Nancy are the current co-owners of City Lights. And as you can see, Lawrence has his original wooden roll-top desk. And we see Lawrence, you know, maybe once a month or so. When I first started 18 years ago, I would see Lawrence on a daily basis, and that was pretty wonderful. But at this point, now that he's 94, he's spending a lot of time painting and doing, you know, other personal pursuits.
The Beat Generation and that particular time in American writing, sure, I mean, that's over. Most of those people aren't here anymore. But the resonance of that in terms of the works themselves and whether and people's interest in those, that has not gone away because we believe in them, too.
That audio postcard was produced by Holly J. McDeed. You can join the folks at City Lights for a 60-year birthday celebration this Sunday with an open house from 2 to 5 p.m. We'll put all of that information at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. If you visit City Lights, you'll probably notice a lot of tourists gazing at a copy of Allen Ginsberg's Howl.
Angel-headed hipsters, burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night.
The bookstore gained national prominence when Ferlinghetti decided to publish Howl in 1956. The seminal poem broke social taboos by talking about drugs and race.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
In an era characterized by conformity, Howl was a call to self-expression. But Howl became much more than that.
Who howled on their knees in the subway and were dragged off the roof waving genitals and manuscripts. Who let themselves be f***ed in the ass by saintly motorcyclists and screamed with joy.
In 1957, Ferlinghetti was put on trial for publishing obscene material.
Pity the nation whose people are sheep. and whose shepherds mislead them. Pity the nation whose leaders are liars, whose sages are silenced, and whose bigots haunt the airwaves.
That trial became a center of the free speech movement, and it brought the Beat Generation, this little bookstore, and this wild poem to the world stage. In 2010, over 50 years after it was written, two filmmakers decided they would adapt this historic work. In this story from our archives, reporter Emily Wilson tells us how they went about making a movie about a poem and freedom of expression. When you're making a movie, you begin with images.
Peyote solidities of halls, backyard green tree cemetery dawns, wine drunkenness over
Allen Ginsberg draws a landscape in words.
Joyride, neon blinking traffic lights, sun and moon and tree vibrations in the roaring winter dusks of Brooklyn.
Filmmakers Rob Epstein and Scott Friedman wanted to capture that in Howl through animation.
Illuminating all the motionless world of time between.
So they made a movie that's as much of an abstract work of art as the poem itself.
If we had made a documentary, we would have been talking to a lot of old-timers remembering back 50 years to something that happened when they were young. But we really wanted to try to capture that youthful, rebellious spirit that gave birth to the poem.
Yakety-yakking, screaming, vomiting, whispering facts and memories and anecdotes and eyeball kicks and shocks of hospitals and jails and wars. Ginsberg collected underground political posters made by Eric Drucker. He's an artist, draws covers for the New Yorker magazine, writes graphic novels. Vivid, kinetic images. Epstein and Friedman told Drucker they wanted him to animate Howl.
Animate Howl. So I thought they were completely nuts. I mean, I thought they, what are you, high on crack? Are you crazy? Animate Howl? Sure, why don't we, well, let's animate Dante's Inferno while we're at it, fellas. Give me a break.
Who ate fire and paint hotels, or drink turpentine in Paradise Alley? Death, or purgatory, their torsos night after night with dreams, with drugs, with waking nightmares.
The language in Howl is like cubism, like jazz.
I guess I would call it kaleidoscopic in its form. It was written in the mid-50s, and it's kind of the tail end of high modernism, what Picasso was doing in painting. What Miles Davis and Charlie Parker were doing with music on the horn, Ginsberg was attempting to do, really for the first time, with words, which was just to have a series of intense, very vivid, very concrete images.
Moloch, whose factories dream and croak in the fog.
This was written 55 years ago.
Moloch, whose love is endless oil and stone.
He was talking about oil and stone.
The Republican candidate for president of the United States today directly tied the Iraq war and the prospects of further American bloodshed in the Middle East to the price and availability of oil.
Oil and stone.
The characters in Howl took shape in Drucker's imagination.
So this is how I portray Moloch, as almost a minotaur-like creature with the head of a bull and a human body, kind of a Schwarzenegger's body.
Hasta la vista.
Head of a bull. In fact, the face even looks a little like Arnold's. Now that I look at it again.
Moloch, whose soul is electricity and banks. Moloch, whose poverty is the specter of genius. Moloch, whose fate is a cloud of sexless hydrogen. Moloch, whose name is the mind. Howl is art. And its history. The three old shrews of fate. The one-eyed shrew of the heterosexual dollar.
The one-eyed shrew
that winks out of the womb. And
the one-eyed shrew that does nothing
but sit on her ass and snip the intellectual golden threads of the craftsman's loom. In 1957, Lawrence Ferlinghetti of City Lights Books in San Francisco faced jail time for publishing obscene material.
Who copulated ecstatic and insatiate with a bottle of beer, a sweetheart, a package of cigarettes, a candle, and fell off the bed, and continued along the floor and down the hall, and ended fainting on the wall with a vision of ultimate and cum, eluding the last jism of consciousness.
What I want to show is on the first page inside of Howell, it says, all these books are published in heaven. And I don't quite understand that. But anyway, let the record show, Your Honor, it's published by the City Lights Pocket Bookshop.
I mean, the issues that are raised are still being debated, you know, the limits of free speech, if any, the role of the artist in society, what's acceptable for an artist to do or say.
You understand what angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night means?
Sir, you can't translate poetry into prose. That's why it is poetry.
Holy forgiveness, mercy, charity, faith. Holy, ours, bodies, suffering, magnanimity. Holy, the supernatural, extra intelligent, brilliant kindness of the soul.
Allen Ginsberg's voice joins with Eric Drucker's animation and Scott Friedman and Rob Epstein's Howl. A new chapter of an American history.
Hey, Father Death. I'm flying home. Hey, poor man, you're all alone.
For Cross Currents, I'm Emily Wilson.
I know where I'm going. Father Death, don't cry anymore.
You can still see images of Allen Ginsberg's Beat Generation taken by the poet himself. They're on display at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in an exhibit called Beat Memories, the Photographs of Allen Ginsberg. It's on display through September 8th. For more information, go to kalw.org.
My heart is still, as time will tell.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Well, the controversy surrounding Allen Ginsberg's Howl was catapulting City Lights Bookstore into the limelight, there was another bookstore over in the Fillmore District that was also making history. Marcus Books opened in 1959 and quickly became a hub for the neighborhood's black community. Founders Julian and Ray Richardson believed it was the first African-American bookstore in America. But now, over 50 years later, Marcus Books is struggling to keep from closing its doors. The building where it operated was sold in bankruptcy court after the family who ran it was unable to keep up with ballooning mortgage payments. Yesterday was the store's eviction date. But advocates are trying to convince the new owners to work with them so that the store can stay open. In this story from our archives, KALW's Holly J. McDeed tells us about the mission Marcus Books has had since the beginning to help African-American youth feel pride in their culture. Here's Holly.
Who taught you, please? Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man?
In the 1960s, black leaders like Malcolm X brought a new consciousness to American race relations.
Who taught you to hate yourself? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other.
Writers such as Amiri Baraka set their perspectives to poetry.
Black art! Poems are bullshit.
The concept of black power found deep roots in the Bay Area's literary world. Amiri Baraka, Sonia Sanchez, Ishmael Reed, as they emerged from the black arts movement, they needed a place to be heard, for their words to be read. That place was Marcus Books, in San Francisco's Fillmore District, once known as the Harlem of the West.
And you saw these black people in business, doctors and lawyers.
Karen Johnson is the daughter of Julian and Ray Richardson. She grew up in the Fillmore shop.
the gas station and the pharmacy and the people who sold the clothes and the shoes and everything in the grocery store was all black businesses.
Marcus Books was in line with the voices of the black community, like those of Oakland Black Panthers, who gained national prominence with displays of militant social resistance.
Let's get into the inner workings and the meaning of this. Let's get into the inner workings and the meaning of a black revolution and why black people have a right to take what's theirs. You can read the platform and the program.
Johnson remembers how the Black Panthers would use her parents' store in the Fillmore as a meeting room.
Huey Newton would be in the store when I came home from high school. And Huey was so handsome, and he was so brave. And my sister and I would come home from school and be, oh, God, it's Huey. Like, we can't even look. We could never even have a conversation with him, you know, because we would have been like, take me.
Johnson says the store drew prominent African Americans from all over the country.
Bill Cosby had been here, and Oprah, and one of my favorites, Barry White, okay? I got a hug from Barry White. Muhammad Ali and Rosa Parks and Chaka Khan. And we've had more writers than the whole Harlem Renaissance.
Karen Johnson currently lives above Marcus Books in San Francisco. It's one of two that's still around today. We walk in past walls painted purple, under Christmas lights strung across the ceiling. Bongo drums are scattered around the floor. When the first branch opened, Johnson tells me, their best-selling books were by historian J.A. Rogers, and they're still popular.
Oh, just got them yesterday, and they're already gone. Because even people who love you and respect you will take your J.A. Rogers books out of your house and not bring them back, huh? So everybody has to keep rebuying them, huh? So all this stuff is footnoted. So people in history that we didn't know were black. Beethoven, did you know Beethoven was black? And at the time when the other composers were... Okay, here he comes with... When it's got some punch like that, that's pretty much your brother, huh? And, you know, a lot of people, when they're doing these classic concerts, don't realize they're playing soul music, but they'll get it eventually, right?
Johnson picks up Hip Hop Speaks to Children, an anthology that highlights the use of rhythm and vernacular in hip-hop, rap, and African-American poetry. The artists range from Langston Hughes to Kanye West.
Let us roam the night together, singing, I love you. Across the Harlem rooftops, moon is shining. Night sky is blue. Stars are great drops of golden dew. Down the street, a band is playing. I love you. Come, let us roam the night together, singing. Whoa! I want to do that. Little Langston goes a long way.
That's Karen Johnson, owner of Marcus Books. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now let's go back to Holly McDeed's profile of Marcus Books.
While Marcus Books still carries Langston Hughes and J.A. Rogers, it moves a lot more of what's called urban fiction. This genre includes books like Holy Hustler, Sugar Daddy's Game, and Girls from the Hood, 1, 2, 3, and 4.
The officer put his forearm in the back of Rip's neck and smashed his face into the hood of the car. Say, man, what in the f*** you doing? JJ said as he got out of the other side of the car. Get your ass on the ground and don't move. Rip spun around, breaking free, putting a set of combinations into the officer's face all in one motion. Rip,
You cool? He asked. Yeah, bro. Let's ride, Rip said. Then JJ heard four more shots as Rip unloaded into the unconscious officer on the ground.
While Johnson was resistant to carrying urban fiction at first, she realized that young African Americans have a different lifestyle from the people who've shopped at Marcus Books through the earlier years.
They're going to be bored by Catcher in the Rye. Their pace is three times faster than ours. We've been boring the mess out of them. Any kid can get a gun and get some drugs. So they need some literature and an art that reflects how to get through that war period. And the urban fiction does that.
Johnson's philosophy is to draw young people in with what they want and then get them interested in what she thinks they need. Last year, a third of California's African American public school students dropped out of high school. The number of black men in prison is higher than the number enslaved in the U.S. in 1850.
If my parents hadn't read that much, I would not have. If they hadn't made me go to the bookstore after school, I would have got into some mess. I don't know if I would have been alive today.
Johnson says that as an adult, her experience was crystallized through the education of her granddaughter, Jasmine. While looking through a collection of her elementary school artwork, she noticed all the drawings were of blonde-haired, blue-eyed people. She went to the school to talk with her teacher.
So I asked the teacher, why does my kid have a hard time being black in your classroom? She said, what do you mean? I said, look at this artwork. There's no one that looks like me. Do you have a brown crayon? I thought maybe if she's brown crayon challenged, I'll buy her a brown crayon, right? She said, I noticed your kid was black, but I never held it against her. My husband and I looked at each other. We're like, you punch her, I'll hold her. I'm like, no, you punch her, I'll hold her. No, you punch her, I'll hold her. So, like, to keep from going to jail, we had to just move to another school.
A black nationalist school called Meadows Livingston, where Marcus Books customer taught.
She told my kid, you? Oh, well, you can read. Of course you can read. Here, take this. Go read this to your mom. That's all there is to it. The attitude the teacher has to you. She could have said, calculus? Well, you can do calculus. Anyway, so that kid is now the youngest person in UC Berkeley's PhD program. Mm-hmm. She's getting her doctorate, and she's like 26 or 27, she'll get her doctorate. It would not have happened without the attitude that she got.
Jasmine Johnson is studying the African diaspora, and when she's got her degree, she plans on returning to the bookstore. She's the youngest generation in the family, the new media generation, and that provides new challenges for the people who run and care about Marcus Books.
Amazon, Nook, Kindle, and all these devices will enable people all over the world to download books immediately, and that's great. That's going to save maybe African-American literature. It's a heroic enterprise.
Author Ishmael Reed knew the original founders of Marcus Books. He still goes to the store to browse and buy, and he and his two daughters, also writers, have given readings there. Reed still carries the passion of the Black Power movement of the 1960s, and he's still provocative. He says his book, Barack Obama and the Jim Crow Media, had to be made in Canada after U.S. publishers refused to print it. You can't find it at Barnes & Noble's, but you can find it at Marcus Books.
I see a Marcus Bookstore as fulfilling an ancient role of preserving the text under attack by members of the Tea Party who want to end ethnic studies. They want to end the study of Arabic. We're undergoing what might be called a book burning. Not literally, but the effect is the same in that the experience and culture of different people that are being erased.
At Marcus Books, though, they are being retained. The writings of Marcus Garvey, the poetry of Langston Hughes, Toni Morrison's Beloved, and then, of course, the multi-generational bookseller's family favorite, a children's story called Flossie and the Fox.
Flossie rocked back on her heels, then up on her toes, carefully studying the creature who was claiming to be a fox. Nope, she said at last, I just purely don't believe it. I don't believe you a fox. My dear child, he said, sounding right disgusted. Of course I'm a fox. Whatever do they teach children these days?
Jasmine Johnson represents the latest chapter in the story of Marcus Brooks. Her mother is part, and her grandmother, and her great-grandmother. They've been sharing stories for generations and building a lot of confidence for their readers along the way. In San Francisco, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
There's a petition to keep Marcus Books open. You can find a link at klw.org. And before we leave you today, all this talk of San Francisco's literary past has got us thinking about the present and what we plan on reading this summer.
This is Audrey Dilling.
Hi, my name is Martina Castro, and I'm the managing editor here at KLW's newsroom.
I'm Matt Martin.
I am Becca Hoekstra, and I am a fill-in producer for Your Call.
I made it a goal. I want to read something by Jonathan Goldstein, who is the host of a CBC show called Wiretap. It's one of my favorite shows, and I've never really read anything by him. I've heard his work on This American Life, and I've heard Wiretap. And he also wrote kind of a memoir book recently that I would like to read because I want to do things like him.
So I've had this book on my shelf forever, and this summer I'm definitely going to make it through the whole thing. It's called The Open Veins of Latin America by Eduardo Galeano. He's my favorite author, and I really love another one of his books, but this was his first, and it's kind of like this must read for anyone who knows anything or wants to know anything about Latin America.
I'd like to go back and finish Don Quixote. I did start reading that. I was enjoying it, but it's one of those things like you really need to commit yourself to the world of the book. And in the time I have in my day, I rarely have that, it seems like. So that's something I'd love to get back to.
It's an anthology. It's called Gender Outlaws, The Next Generation by Kate Bornstein. And I struggle a lot with gender identity and, like, the idea of multiple genders and whatnot. And this was just a really incredible book with stories from a wide variety of people with all sorts of expressions and gender identities that didn't fit inside male or female. And it was just incredibly exciting to see that there were stories of people who struggled with the same thing I did and had found solutions and hope and friends and families that also accepted them for this same kind of weird struggle that they were going through. And it was really, really cool to find just acceptance within a book.
Those book recommendations were gathered by KALW's Leah Rose. If you have any books to add to our list or ones you've had sitting on your shelf for years and are swearing you're going to get to this summer, give us a call and let us know. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again is 264-7106, or you can drop us a line at our Facebook page. We're KALW. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Julie Kane, Teddy Lederer, Linda Jew, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Alyssa Kapnick, Seth Samuel, Leah Rose, Judy Silber, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And we want to thank you. KALW is independent, listener-supported public radio.
The sounds you're hearing are by Gautam Ganeshan. He'll be bringing his innovative Indian roots music to the Redwood Grove Summer Concert Series at the UC Berkeley Botanical Garden tomorrow. Audience members are invited to bring a picnic and enjoy sitting under the redwoods while listening. Music begins at 5:30 p.m., and your ticket includes entrance to the Botanical Garden starting at 4:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. Thank you.